patients with kidney failure have upwards of 16 times more surgeries compared to people that have normal kidney function.
One of the patients actually asked a clinical question that what is my risk for cardiovascular mortality at 5 years if I have CKM stage 3. So that's how we thought it's a unique opportunity to put forward and validate this staging system.
In clinic, when you get a patient with type 1 diabetes, oftentimes your heart kind of sinks because you don't have a lot of options to treat them with. And SGLT2 inhibitors are on that list of medications that are often referred to as being contraindicated. Welcome to another episode of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks from Duke University, and today we will review articles from the ASN portfolio of journals that each bring fresh insights into the connection between the cardiovascular system and the kidney. First up, we'll review a study in JASN examining the New American Heart Association Cardiovascular Kidney Metabolic, or CKM, syndrome staging, and how it determines cardiovascular mortality using the NHANES database. Next, we'll look into a study published in Kidney 360, examining the development of a risk prediction model to estimate the risk of post-operative cardiac events and mortality in patients with kidney failure having non-cardiac surgery. Finally, we'll delve into a study from CJASN, which investigates the potential benefits of using SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with type 1 diabetes. Stay tuned as we unpack these important findings, bringing you insights on how they could impact patient care and the future of nephrology. Let's get started. I'm joined by Dr. Sophie Claudel, a second-year nephrology fellow at Boston University, and Dr. Ashish Verma, an assistant professor at Boston University, to talk about their paper published in JASN titled Cumulative Incidence of Mortality Associated with the Cardiovascular Kidney Metabolic, or CKM, Syndrome. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation. We're happy to have you here.
Hi, I'm Sophie Claudel, a second-year fellow at Boston Medical Center, Boston University School of Medicine. I have been working closely with Dr. Verma the last couple of years, also very interested in the interaction between kidney and cardiovascular diseases.
Hi, I'm Ashish Verma. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. My research focus is to study interaction of cardiovascular kidney metabolic diseases. Happy to be here.
Well, wonderful. Also, when just tell our listeners, Sophie, you are basically just a few weeks out from being a first year. So that's really incredible to have a paper of this caliber, first author in JASN. So congratulations.
Thank you. A lot of support came from our co-authors and my mentor, Dr. Verma.
Let's jump right in here. So cardiovascular kidney metabolic, or CKM, syndrome is just a pretty new concept. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins and really why is this such an important concept for us as nephrologists?
Cardiovascular kidney metabolic health was a concept that the American Heart Association published a little over a year ago to really bring together three very related conditions in a framework that would help multidisciplinary providers coordinate their care. And it adds a lot to the prior classification systems by looking at the interactions between organs.
Well, maybe we could go into more detail. What are the variables that you need and what are the stages of this syndrome?
There are four stages in CKM syndrome. Stage zero is considered zero risk factors, so a completely healthy adult. Stage one starts with overweight or obesity, defined by BMI or waist circumference, as well as impaired fasting glucose. Stage two incorporates metabolic risk factors such as cardiovascular biomarkers like troponin and BNP, as well as risk prediction scores looking at high 10-year CVD risk and more advanced chronic kidney disease. And then stage four is clinical cardiovascular disease, so individuals who've already met an endpoint such as having an MI or a stroke or kidney failure.
There's a lot of different variables. So how do you take into account, say you're seeing a patient, you want to sort of figure out which stage they're in. How many of these variables do you need? And if they're missing a lot of them, how can you be confident you're classifying them in the right stage?
The benefit of this system is that a lot of the variables are routinely collected in clinical care. So in most individuals, you will have a blood pressure, you will have typically a creatinine value with an associated GFR. And oftentimes, adults in the U.S. have had lipids tested for routine primary care. So the majority of time, these variables should be available. And the system does not require that every single one be checked. It just, the available data that you have can be used to classify an individual. And if needed, screening can be performed to assess those that are missing at the time of the visit.
I think one thing that I really love about this is that patients have a spectrum of disease. And also, if you look at kidney disease and cardiovascular disease, very similar mechanisms. We as humans have decided to name things based upon the organ in which we're interested in. And I really love how if you look at stage four, for instance, basically if you have kidney disease or cardiovascular disease, oftentimes they coincide, but it does not necessarily have a separate staging for one or the other by itself. And I think that to me is like really a very strong and powerful message that these are very similar or same diseases, and they have the same medicines that typically we use. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so historically, we know that there is a bidirectional relationship between diabetes, cardiovascular disease, metabolic dysfunction, and chronic kidney disease. This classification is very holistic and inclusive. It brings about this continuum and bidirectional relationship in all of these disorders and put forward a classification where, you know, it precises that there is coexistence of multiple diseases in individuals and put forward more important how to take care of them in a multidisciplinary approach.
Well, that's great. I want to hear from Sophie. You're a nephrology fellow and you're seeing patients, and there's often the divide between cardiology and nephrology. Is this the love letter to bring us together?
That is the hope, I think, in those who wrote this original classification system. And it really is nice the way it harmonizes the two fields. I think, as you brought up earlier, the medications really do overlap nowadays, and we should be thinking together about how to get people on optimal therapies. And so I think this not only helps subspecialties coordinate their care, but also invites primary care to really think through how each of these different disciplines is caring for the same patient.
Well, I think now let's talk about your paper. What exactly were you trying to do? What was the research question you're trying to answer with your current paper published in JASN?
We came into this to study this research question. We got a motivation from AKF podcast that me and Sophie did. And one of the patients actually asked a clinical question that what is my risk for cardiovascular mortality at 5 years if I have CKM stage 3? So that's how we thought, you know, it's a unique opportunity to put forward and validate this staging system using a database which is consists of community dwelling adults and actually, you know, project a whole U.S. population.
So you're telling me that your paper, the idea came from a podcast from a patient. That's pretty cool. And so I guess that's a great question is, okay, they've made this classification system and have these stages 0 through 4. You know, how well does it really predict cardiovascular disease? It sounds like a really important question. And I'm really happy to see that it came from a patient, which they often ask. And many times you don't really have a good answer. So tell us about the methodology, Sophie, and how you went about this.
We decided to use a nationally representative data set called NHANES, which includes adults from across the United States. And these adults are met in their community and undergo medical screening and interviews. So it's a really useful data set because patients are in their steady state. They're not in the hospital. They're otherwise well enough to participate in a research study. And we classified all of the adults in this data set between 1999 and 2018. And we sorted them into CKM stages. And then we looked at their cardiovascular mortality, both in terms of absolute risk and relative risk. The reason I bring up those two is because it's much easier for patients and clinicians to conceptualize absolute risk. If I tell you, you have a 5% chance of whatever outcome in 3 years, for example, it's much easier to understand than the odds ratio was 1.4 or the hazard ratio was 2.0. which is much harder for us to put into numbers. And so we felt it was important in this paper to show both absolute and relative risk in a way that would help clinicians actually counsel their patients based on our findings.
I'm looking at the first table, and there's almost over 50,000 participants that were included. Wow, that's a lot of data points. Another interesting thing is that it seems that most are clustering in stage two and then stage three, and then it sort of goes on the edges from there. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Because NHANES participants are community-dwelling adults, we tend to not see the sickest members of the population represented. As well, we may not see the healthiest members of the population because they may not be interested in participating in research. So that's why we tend to see clustering in stage two and stage three. We outlined very carefully in our manuscript how we defined the CKM stages with the available data points that we had. And there are, of course, limitations to anything, and we don't have every single marker possible. But as much as we could, we strictly adhered to the CKM staging system. And I suspect because of the prevalence of underlying diseases in our nation is why we have relatively fewer people who are stage zero and one. We adhered to the CKD definition of using both eGFR less than 60 and a UACR, or urine albumin to creatinine ratio, of greater than 30 milligrams per gram. So that will inherently classify more people into having CKD with a relatively lower urine albumin creatinine ratio. This may, again, be one of the reasons why we see more participants in stage two who may not otherwise be aware of their CKD diagnosis.
Yeah, I'm looking at the, the average UACRs. And even if you go up to stage four, it's pretty low in the 10 range. So that's a very interesting observation as well.
Yes, the median UACR is pretty low across the population, but there is quite a lot of variability within that. If we could actually show you the data, you would see there are people with, nephrotic range proteinuria, and there are people with undetectable proteinuria. So it's really quite a range.
Well, let's go on and figure out the cardiovascular risk of this group of individuals. So how did you calculate that in each of these groups?
So we actually, like Sophie said, we tried to show both relative risk and absolute risk. And we wanted to make sure that this staging has a prognostic relevance independent of continuous risk factors like LDL, systolic blood pressure, hemoglobin A1C, urine albumin to creatinine ratio, and eGFR. So if you see our models, multivariable models, we adjusted for those variables. And that actually show you that these stages in itself actually have a prognostic relevance independent of all these continuous risk factors. So it's adding something above checking these continuous risk factors.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing. If you're going to spend time to calculate a new stage that doesn't really add much to what we traditionally do, it might not be worth doing. So I think that is a really important step for this.
And to go back to your question, we classified cardiovascular risk in two different ways. First, we incorporated the PREVENT score, which is a new ASCVD or CVD classification risk score by the American Heart Association that is more comprehensive evaluation than the prior pooled 10-year equation. And our outcome variable was cardiovascular mortality, which was derived directly from the U.S. National Death Index. So minimizing, hopefully, misclassification bias, as these individuals were all registered as deceased.
And also, we want to emphasize that PREVENT score is one of the scores which actually uses kidney function marker first time for cardiovascular risk assessment. So it uses UACR, which was not used by pool cohort equation before, or framing risk cohort equation. So there's another step of integrating cardiovascular and kidney care by using kidney disease markers as well for cardiovascular risk assessment.
Well, I think you already alluded to the fact that this staging for kidney cardiovascular is better or adds something more than just UACR or the traditional way we did it. I'm looking at figure one, and the Kaplan-Meier curve looks like, for stage four, clearly increases the cardiovascular risk. After that, you sort of have a clustering of three and two, and then stage zero and stage one are pretty much the same. Can you sort of talk us through how these different stages really impact cardiovascular risk?
Yeah, so we didn't find any major difference in absolute risk or relative risk between stage 0 and 1. Similar kind of risk over 10 years or 15 years, showing not a major difference, maybe a very good opportunity for prevention. Regarding stage 3 and 4, unfortunately, we did not have any data on cardiac biomarkers or echocardiographic findings. So maybe that's also playing a role here to capture subclinical cardiovascular disease. That's why you see a similar or not little bit different risk between stage 2 and 3. And then stage 4 is, you know, superseded at a very high risk compared to stages 0, 1, 2, or 3.
So I just want to also clarify, we're talking about cardiovascular mortality risk here. So let's go back to your patient on the podcast. And so, you know, I'm coming to see Dr. Claudel in clinic, and I happen to be in stage 3 of CKM. What is my mortality risk in 10 to 15 years?
As a patient with CKM stage 3, in 10 years, the risk of cardiovascular death would be around 4.7%, and at 15 years, 8.7%. We also could tell you if you were able to, for example, modify your lifestyle to regress in some way back to stage 2, that you could add X number of months of survival time. And so that's also reflected in our absolute risk difference calculations, the number of months of survival between each stage.
What are some surprising things that you found? And maybe we can sort of talk a little bit about all the different variables that you put into this to adjust for, like you said, UACR and other factors. How did that change the result?
We adjusted for, as Ashish mentioned, all of the clinical variables that are within the definition of CKM syndrome. So for example, systolic blood pressure, EGFR, UACR. And we also incorporated factors such as medication use. So medications that have known cardiovascular benefit, such as ACE inhibitors and ARBs, as well as statins, for example. We incorporated all of those to try to refine our models to give us the most accurate reflection of what this staging system actually predicts in terms of mortality, so as not to be confounded by these other clinical variables. We did a number of sensitivity analyses adjusting for additional factors such as social determinants of health, and we saw overall similar results, although the more variables that you adjust for, the more attenuated the results become.
So what does that mean for someone looking at these stages and how it's predicting outcomes when you're adjusting for all these things and still having a result that is predicting mortality?
So that's a very interesting question. So I think it shows you interconnectedness of, you know, these multiple risk factors portraying risk independent of continuous risk factors, which are like LDL, EGFR, UACR, systolic blood pressure, hemoglobin A1C. So this is a unique staging system, which is very specific to cardiovascular mortality. We also did a model where we look at non-cardiovascular mortality and cancer mortality, and this staging was not that good in terms of prognosis.
Essentially, this tells us, again, that the staging system is specific to cardiovascular disease. It's not representing a general inflammatory state or some other milieu that would well predict cancer mortality. It actually is specific to cardiovascular mortality.
Any last comments we all like to make about your paper?
I think the key message here, in addition to the main finding of graded risk between these risk factors and risk for cardiovascular mortality, is there are really a lot of opportunities for prevention and for implementation of medications that we know slow the progression of both kidney and cardiovascular disease. We don't yet fully understand how people move between CKM syndrome stages and how risk would change if you were able to modify some of these risk factors. And so I think it's an exciting opportunity for primary care, nephrology, cardiology, endocrinology to really focus on how do we prevent these outcomes in these patients, knowing that as we see them progress through CKM stages, their risk is magnified each time.
And also this staging system brings a lot of awareness in patients about importance of direction relationship with multiple diseases. they should think that if they have diabetes with cardiovascular disease and CKD, they are at very higher risk for cardiovascular mortality.
We're currently at a stage where in the EMRs, we're having the KFRE for every single patient that has eGFR less than 60 right on the front page of the EMR. Do you think there's a opportunity or time where the CKM stage also will appear?
Yes, I think that would be great. You know, we have incorporated many risk equations into EMRs over the years, but I think having something patients can hold on to as a CKM stage that brings all of their comorbidities together and being able to share that with them will empower patients to really understand their health. And I think the American Heart Association has put out a number of patient-related resources that are perhaps a little more understandable than what they may have heard from their individual subspecialists. So if we could incorporate that, it'd be a great step.
Yeah, maybe it would be also nice to have for each of these stages some action items for the patient to do to address some of these issues, to potentially move them down to a lower stage and diminish their cardiovascular mortality risk. Well, thank you so much to both of you, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on this really important paper. It's very exciting to see this really important area be addressed in this manner. So thank you to both of you. And thanks for our listeners to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We hope to see you here next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
The next paper we'll discuss is from Kidney 360, and the title is Predicting Postoperative Cardiac Events and Mortality for People with Kidney Failure Having Non-Cardiac Surgery. I'm very excited to be joined by Dr. Tyrone Harrison, who is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Matt. I'm really happy to be here and really happy to talk about this study. My name is Tyrone Harrison. I'm a researcher and nephrologist within Calgary, which is a large city just on the western side of the Rocky Mountains in Alberta. And I'd like to actually take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories, the people of the Treaty 7 region of southern Alberta, which includes the Blackfoot Confederacy, comprising the Siksika, the Piikani, and the Kainai First Nations, the Tsuut'ina First Nation, and the Stoney Nakoda, which includes the Chiniki, Bearspaw, and Goodstoney First Nations. And City of Calgary is also home to the Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. So really happy to be here to represent this stellar research group that we got to work on this study with. So thank you for the invite.
This is a very interesting paper. It seems like a lot of focus is put on to cardiac surgery. And maybe you can talk a little bit about where this paper came from. And are there prior studies looking at non-cardiac surgery in patients with kidney failure?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of research now that has gone into the non-cardiac surgery world, really looking at what sort of outcomes they have afterwards. And there's a quite significant cardiac risk that actually comes with a lot of non-cardiac surgeries. So patients that are going in for common surgeries, such as hip replacements, knee replacements, are actually having major cardiac events afterwards at a much higher rate than one might estimate. So yes, there's a lot of research that has gone into identifying the risk of non-cardiac surgery for many people having hip replacements, knee replacements, all the other types of surgery that are very commonly performed across the world. And they've actually found there's quite a significant cardiac risk associated with many of these surgeries for these patients. And there's certain variables that predict higher risk of these outcomes actually occurring. And as we all know, people with kidney disease have very high cardiovascular risk in many other settings. And so we really wanted to try to unpack that a little bit more and conduct some research on this very important and very highly comorbid patient population of people with kidney failure. So yes, there is research out there that's looked at outcomes in many different surgery types, whether it's orthopedic surgery, major abdominal surgery, and other major surgery types. And I found that almost ubiquitously, people with kidney failure have a much higher risk of death, cardiac events such as a myocardial infarction, but other important events such as infections, a longer readmission, or longer hospital length of stay, and increased risk of readmission. So many postoperative outcomes are increased in this patient population.
So one thing I was very intrigued about is that the desire for your group to really have a prediction model that could be used in real time to help guide. Can you explain a little bit about how that might work?
Commonly across the perioperative space and anesthesia world and internal medicine and perioperative medicine spaces, many clinicians are actually using risk prediction tools already to predict the risk of major cardiac events, death after surgery. There's tools such as the Revised Cardiac Risk Index. There's some American College of Surgery tools that are also used across North America. And what we actually found was that tools designed for use in the general surgical population actually didn't perform very well when they were applied to kidney failure populations. So we actually conducted a validation study to look at the RCRI, or that Revised Cardiac Risk Index, which actually recommended in Canada and many other places to be used. And we found that it actually performed very poorly. We overestimated the risk for many people with kidney failure. And because there was a kidney disease variable within the model that really didn't discriminate between people with mild chronic kidney disease and people with more advanced stages or kidney failure, it really didn't perform very well in these patients that have unique considerations in the perioperative space. So that sort of was our motivation to develop unique tools for this very important patient population that has up to a 12% risk of having a heart attack or dying within 30 days with unique perioperative considerations, whether the dialysis patient, non-dialysis patient, their own unique comorbidity profile. So we really wanted to develop something that was designed to work in this patient population that really didn't have a tool that met their needs at this time. And so that was our purpose.
Just curious about your take on that. Oftentimes we know they're at higher risk. Do you think that would maybe make surgeons less likely to perform operations on patients with kidney failure if they see a really high score?
I'm not really sure, truthfully, how this would be seen by surgeons. I know there is a lot of renalism that goes into perioperative planning, and a lot of our patients often are denied surgeries that people without kidney failure may have been offered. And so I feel like, you know, having more accurate estimates to provide and inform perioperative decision making, I feel like that would be helpful for patients and clinicians. When we look at other tools that have been developed and recommended widely for use, they often overestimate the risk for people with kidney failure. And so more accurate tools designed specifically for these patients might actually provide more detailed and accurate risk estimates. And I think a patient as well, like oftentimes patients aren't actually informed of their risk. It's often in perioperative notes and anesthesia consults, but patients often have no idea about what the risk is going in. And so I think having that piece of information to know, hey, maybe if my risk is 20% of having a postoperative major cardiac event or dying, and it's some perhaps minor procedure that the patient really, you know, wasn't set on actually having for sure completed, that perhaps that would inform their decision to maybe not pursue surgery themselves. So I think it's not just for the clinicians, but also for the patients. And it really is just it's a number and it's part of the conversation. And these tools aren't perfect, but they're certainly an improvement on other models that have been developed.
That makes sense. So not only will it maybe they get a better interpretation of their risk, although a lot of people might assume it's high for everything, it could be lower in many circumstances, and that's a very valuable thing to know. Tell us a little bit about how you did this study. Obviously, the Canadian research has a lot of really great cohorts of patients that can do these studies. So tell us, what did you use?
Yeah, absolutely. So as mentioned, we have really great administrative health data sets across much of the country. Within each province, and Alberta being one province that I'm from, and Manitoba was another province where the first author, Gurpreet Pabla, who just actually defended his master's as part of his master's thesis, Navdeep Tangri, who is his supervisor. And they're from Manitoba, and they work with an excellent data source as well. And so we're really able to capture population level data. So for all patients that have kidney failure within each province, we're able to capture information about their comorbidities and dialysis profile, and a lot of information about their surgeries and laboratory values, et cetera. So this really makes for super rich data sources for us to use to develop risk prediction tools. We're not able to access some things like inpatient clinical data or blood pressure values and things like that, but we're really able to access a lot of data for sometimes decades prior to surgical events. There's a lot of risk prediction research that has happened in Canada. And I shouldn't say that it's just unique to our provinces. There's a lot of great administrative health data sets across the country. So we're really lucky in that sense. So yeah, this study specifically, we developed the models in Alberta. And then this paper really was focused on testing models that had been developed in Alberta within a unique province, so within the Manitoba setting. And so we used administrative health data from those sources, lab sources as well from the same province, and were really able to capture everybody within Manitoba that was a patient with kidney failure that had surgery and see what happened to them within the 30 days after surgery. So it was really a great data source to work with.
Oh, it's interesting that it looks like of the patients that you sampled, each one had about an average of 3 surgeries. Is that right?
Yeah. So essentially, patients with kidney failure, as mentioned, they're comorbid. They have many procedures. We've done some other research that has looked at incidence of surgery, and they have upwards of 16 times more surgeries compared to people that have normal kidney function. And these are things, these are not just minor procedures. These are procedures where they're admitted to hospital for at least a night. So they're big deals for these patients. And I think often people have no idea how many surgeries patients with kidney failure are having, but it certainly is a lot more than general population. And so with each surgery, if you have a substantial risk of having a major cardiac event or death, like this is quite a significant health burden on this patient population.
Yeah, further underscores the importance of a study like this. Just sort of thinking about that, like we're sending them for PD catheter placements, getting fistulas, individuals that are working on getting a transplant evaluation have to go through a lot of different hoops. So, wow, 12 times more than a general population. I never knew that.
Mm-hmm. And then the interesting part too, like you mentioned, those kidney specific procedures, so PD catheters, fistulas, transplants, that only really accounts for about a quarter of the overall surgery. So still 75% of surgeries that people with kidney failure are having are non-related procedures. So they're the hip replacements, they're the intra-abdominal procedures, there's a cholecystectomy and things like that. So they're having other surgical procedures that are really not related to their kidney disease, which is quite an interesting.
So maybe you can just, our audience, like what was the first paper that was done? The first internal validation study?
Yeah, so we developed 3 different models within Alberta. This is back a few years now. Actually, it was my last project during my PhD. And so we developed a series of 3 different nested models. One very simple model, which included variables such as their kidney failure type, their surgical type, age, sex, very basic model that we hypothesized that would be more useful maybe in a surgical clinic setting where perhaps the surgeon might not know every detail about their dialysis prescription and things like that, but would know the basic surgical information. The second model was a bit more complex, would require some information about the comorbidities. So we included comorbidities in addition to all the variables listed in model 1. And then model 3 included preoperative albumin and hemoglobin, as well as different commonly performed laboratory tests. As we developed these tools, we tested them and they performed pretty well within Alberta. The more complex model did perform the best, but you know, we developed the 3 models with different complexities so that if you were coming from a setting that maybe didn't have access to the laboratory values or you weren't sure about all the comorbidities, you would still have a reasonably well performing and simple tool to use. And so those 3 models all performed well. We tested them in Manitoba, and overall, they did perform quite well even without updating any of the coefficients to adapt to the Manitoba data. When we did update the coefficients, re-estimated the coefficient variables, the tools all did perform a little bit better, which is to be expected, with they were accurate, they were high performing as well with most of our model performance estimates.
So to just reiterate back on those models, the first one had age, sex, dialysis modality, surgery type, and setting.
That's right.
And what's the setting? Is that like if you're admitted to the hospital versus an outpatient center?
So when we looked at surgery setting, really this is a categorical variable. We categorize them as having an ambulatory or an outpatient elective surgery versus having an inpatient elective surgery. So where it was planned beforehand. So if you were going for a hip replacement, had to stay in hospital for a night or a few nights, that would be an inpatient elective surgery. Or if you were coming in and you had an inpatient urgent or emergent surgery, so that would be, you know, coming in with acute cholecystitis or something like that. So something that was unplanned, that would be an urgent or emergent procedure. So that's how we applied that variable across all the tools.
Great. And the second model just has all those things in the first model, but added comorbidities. And then the third model, all of the above, plus the addition of a preoperative hemoglobin and albumin.
That's correct.
Just curious about those 3 models. Like, as you start adding more things, is it necessary? Does it make it more accurate? Or is there a certain step where you say, okay, we don't really need the preoperative hemoglobin or an albumin? How much does that really affect the output of what you get from doing this prediction modeling?
It's a good question. And that's what we tested with our original study and actually within this validation study as well. We did find that with the addition of the more complex variables, comorbidities plus lab values, that with each series of more complex models, they did perform a little bit better, whether that actually was clinically meaningful, less so. We did some tests looking at net reclassification to see whether or not a statistically significant number of patients were correctly reclassified with the addition of these more complex variables. And there was some significant reclassification. So the overall message, or how I interpret those findings from the original study, was that all models performed quite well if you did have access to those more complex variables, that the most complex model, including the lab values, actually performed the best and would predict outcomes most accurately. But if you didn't have preoperative albumin and hemoglobin, it was fine, and you still would be able to provide a pretty reasonable estimate and accurate estimate with the less complex models.
Well, it's very interesting, and I guess what I want to know is, like, at what point can we start using it, and what are the next steps to get it to prime time?
Yeah, great question. So we're still in the pipeline of developing these tools. Part of that is making sure that we're developing the tools, internally validating them. And then the next step, if we're able to show that our tools perform reasonably well within our development setting, is to really test them in an external setting, whether that be another geographically distinct place, so another province, another country, something like that, whether it's in a temporally distinct period, so a more recent time period within our own province, or if it's in a different domain too. So if you looked at how it performed at predicting other postoperative outcomes. And so really, right now, with this external testing of our models within Manitoba, they performed really well. We updated them and they performed even better. This really provides some evidence that these tools would likely generalize to other settings that have similar healthcare delivery. And so next, in our mind, the next step really is for us to test them in another setting, perhaps a US-based facility that has a bit different healthcare delivery, a different healthcare insurance, things like that, and perhaps a European site as well. But really, the message isn't that we develop these tools, we externally validate them, and once we get the green light and the check mark within that setting, that these tools should just be used wherever and whenever. In my mind, and in many other people that develop risk prediction tools, these tools should be updated and re-estimated within each setting that has their own unique healthcare delivery and patient populations.
First off, fantastic work to you and your colleagues on doing the work to make this really important tool to help our patients. We really appreciate that. Is there any last comments that you would like to make?
Yeah, so I'd really like to thank all the researchers that worked on this project. And as mentioned before, we had a master's student complete this validation work, Gurpreet Pabla from Manitoba, and he did an excellent job at testing these tools and validating them within Manitoba. And so kudos to him. So it was really excellent to work with him and with Navdeep Tangri and some others within Manitoba. So kudos to the entire group. And if anybody is interested in testing these tools in other settings and they have a data source that they'd like to test them within, please reach out. We'd be happy to collaborate.
And the final paper we'll be covering is from C. Jason, titled Modeling Cardiorenal Protection with SGLT2 Inhibition in Type 1 Diabetes. We have Dr. Vikas Sridhar, who is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. Spark. It's a pleasure to join you today on the podcast. So I'm a nephrologist with a focus on kidney and kidney pancreas transplantation, based out of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss our study. I think this is an important space that we're going to be seeing a lot of exciting work in, work that I truly believe will help our patients improve the care that we're able to offer them and eventually their outcomes as well.
It's an important topic in a clinic. When you get a patient with type 1 diabetes, oftentimes your heart kind of sinks because you don't have a lot of options to treat them with. And SGLT2 inhibitors are on that list of medications that are often referred to as being contraindicated. So maybe we can first talk about the background about this paper that you're currently going to discuss today and how you sort of got to where you are now.
Absolutely. You're completely correct. And it's not just SGLT2 inhibitors, it's GLP-1 receptor agonists, as well as the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, as well as other therapies in the pipeline. For the most part, you know, these drugs have been wonderful with high quality evidence involving tens of thousands of participants. And we now use these agents alone or in combination as part of the established guideline-directed medical therapy for diabetic kidney disease. But all of these studies, for the most part, excluded individuals with type 1 diabetes. And these are patients. It's not a large patient population compared to type 2 diabetes, but it's a very morbid population, and they are at incredibly high risk of cardiovascular disease as well as kidney disease, especially when they start to have microalbuminuria, macroalbuminuria, as well as chronic kidney disease. So it's with that lens in mind, and the fact that we really don't have a lot of therapies for them beyond glycemic control and perhaps RAS blockade, that we actually decided to explore this topic. And this particular study was actually part one of a larger grant that is currently in motion to evaluate the effects of SGLT2 inhibitors in individuals with type 1 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. We decided that we wanted to add to the background literature out there that these agents can be used to improve cardiovascular and kidney outcomes in people with type 1 diabetes beyond just glycemic lowering effects. So with that in mind, our goal was to evaluate the effects on SGLT2 inhibition on estimated cardiovascular and estimated risk of developing end-stage kidney disease. And to do that, we actually were able to get access to the DEPICT-1 and DEPICT-2 participant-level trial data using the Vivli platform. Just to summarize, DEPICT-1 and 2 are actually completed multi-center phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trials investigating mainly the safety and the glycemic efficacy of dapagliflozin as an add-on to insulin therapy in individuals with type 1 diabetes that had not reached glycemic targets. So just to clarify, this is not a population with diabetic kidney disease, but rather relatively healthy individuals, but with type 1 diabetes with elevated A1C. And they were randomized in a one-to-one manner to either dapagliflozin 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams versus placebo for a period of 24 weeks with a subsequent 28 long-term extension. So data up to 52 weeks. And in total, there were 758 participants in DEPICT-1 and 780 participants in DEPICT-2. So we were able to get access to this completed study.
I just want to sort of pause here and go back to our original discussion point about SGLT2 inhibitors. And I think we need to talk about the elephant in the room in that I think, you know, from my recollection of this, is many people would love to use these drugs and aren't really concerned about them working or not. We probably believe they will work in patients with type 1 diabetes, but it's their risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. Does this study do anything to clarify that to allow us to have more comfort in using it? I mean, I think having multiple studies to show that they work in many different populations, why would they not work in type 1 diabetes? I just want to hear your comment surrounding that. I think that's one of the more crucial issues with these drugs.
I completely agree. So there is this background risk of diabetic ketoacidosis with these agents. In fact, part of how they work, a physiologic standpoint, is to induce these, you know, whether you can call them starvation pathways or metabolic shifts, that actually does lead to the creation of ketone bodies, which is probably part of how they work and part of their effectiveness, perhaps improving renal energetics or even energetics at the other organ levels. So ketosis is part and parcel. It becomes more of an issue when you are dealing with individuals with type 1 diabetes who, due to their insulin deficiency, are at risk of developing diabetic ketoacidosis. And this is clear from meta-analyses of completed studies with these agents, including DEPICT 1 and 2, that using these agents in people with type 1 diabetes does increase the risk of DKA. There's a couple of ways to view that, and it really ends up being a risk-benefit analysis. So in terms of the risk of DKA, there perhaps is already some early evidence that using these agents in individuals with more advanced CKD may be actually associated with a lower risk of that diabetic ketoacidosis. And this is based on some preliminary analyses, including some that we have completed as well. And the rationale behind that is with more advanced CKD, perhaps you have less glucosuria, you have less of that glycemic effect. And perhaps as a result, you have less pulling back of insulin by physicians, and that maybe leads to less ketogenesis and perhaps lower rates of diabetic ketoacidosis. So that's one thing. The other thing is that a lot of the early studies when we did use these agents in people with type 1 diabetes were done before we had a complete understanding of this risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. And it's been shown that when you have really high quality DKA risk mitigation protocols, such as careful ketone monitoring, especially as we move into the generation of much better glycemic and continuous, potentially even continuous ketone monitoring. We're actually able to detect ketones at a lower level, adjust the therapy accordingly, including increasing insulin or giving a drug holiday from the SGLT2 inhibitors to actually prevent this from developing into full-blown DKA. So on the risk side of the equation, I think perhaps we're working towards actually reducing that risk of diabetic ketoacidosis while recognizing that it's always going to be part of the equation. But on the other side, as you start to use these agents in higher and higher risk cohorts, so not quite risk cohorts such as in DEPICT 1 and 2, where you know these are people with without significant cardiovascular and kidney disease, but rather if you start to use this in higher risk cohorts, individuals with more advanced CKD with higher levels of albuminuria, that benefit side of the equation is going to be greater. And ideally what you want to do is you want to shift that in favor of greater benefits for lower risks. And I think when we've actually spoken with patients, people with lived experience, people with diabetes, and you actually do offer them this choice of this is a particular agent which may have benefits of preventing cardiovascular disease and slowing down kidney disease progression, but there is a risk of DKA that we recognize and perhaps can offer strategies to reduce the risk of, they are willing to accept that choice. So I think the landscape that we're heading into is different from where we started in the early days of these agents when we actually did a lot of these type 1 diabetes studies and didn't necessarily recognize this and had not completely played out these risks of cardiovascular disease protection and kidney disease protection. This particular study that we're going to talk about does not dive into that. We focus on the benefit side of the equation, especially in people at relatively low baseline risk of cardiovascular disease and kidney disease. But we just wanted to add to that. And there are many other studies, including some that we can talk about later, that are exploring the other side of the equation as well.
What were the gaps in knowledge about their benefit in type 1 diabetes that this study is going to unravel?
We do not have any outcome data in terms of the reductions of cardiovascular risk and kidney disease risk with SGLT inhibitors in this patient population.
So basically you're saying is there's no studies that had that as a primary outcome, both cardiovascular disease or kidney outcomes. There were more maybe diabetic control studies. What were the outcomes of those studies?
They were all studies that were designed around glycemic endpoints. There are not that many studies. So you have DEPICT 1 and 2, which was a dapagliflozin. You had the EASE studies with empagliflozin. And then you have the in tandem studies with sotagliflozin. So there isn't actually a whole lot of data. These were phase 3 studies with reasonably large populations, but they were all designed to look at glycemic endpoints. They were not enriched for cardiovascular and kidney outcomes. These were in the early days mainly based around glycemic reductions.
Definitely a big gap, because if we're going to start pushing these drugs into this high risk population, that DKA could become maybe less of a risk of the protection that you might get from these medications, having better understanding of that benefit would be very important.
Yes, I think you really need to quantify those benefits and quantify those risks. Now, I want to be clear, the study that we're discussing is a step in that direction, but is by no means definitive. We primarily looked at estimated risk equations, applied them at baseline before the initiation of therapy, and applied them after a modest period of therapy. So I just want to be very clear, this is a step in that direction, and I think it adds to the rationale, and perhaps this is a good segue into the results for actually doing some of these trials that will generate the data that we need to actually use these agents with confidence in our patients with type 1 diabetes and kidney disease or cardiovascular disease.
Maybe first we can hear about what were the baseline characteristics that you were comparing when you got the patients from these randomized control trials.
So the analyzed cohort was about 53% female with a mean age of 40 and a duration of type 1 diabetes of 20 years. The mean BMI was roughly 24.8. And like I mentioned earlier, this was not a particularly comorbid cohort. 9% had a prior cardiovascular disease event. And chronic kidney disease was observed in 16% of participants, but this was based on a relatively broad definition of chronic kidney disease. So about 1% had an eGFR of less than 60, 15%, which is the majority, had a UACR above 30 milligrams per gram, and just 1% had both. So just to summarize, it's a relatively low-risk cohort compared to the outcome studies that we have seen in the type 2 diabetes patient population. And I'll first start with the changes in the estimated cardiovascular risk. We first applied the Steno type 1 diabetes risk engine, and I'll focus on the 24-week period of treatment because we had the most amount of data at that time point. And what we saw was that the placebo-adjusted relative change from baseline in risk was about 6.19%. And there was an absolute change from baseline of a reduction of 0.66%. And at 52 weeks, there was a larger percentage of patients that were excluded, mostly because we were missing lipid profiles, which we need to calculate these scores. And it was mostly sustained with a 5.83 placebo-adjusted relative change from baseline and a minus 0.77% reduction in the risk of absolute change. And we had roughly similar changes when we looked at the Scottish Diabetes Research Network, which is supposed to underestimate compared to the Steno risk engine, the risk of cardiovascular disease. And in that particular case, at 24 weeks, the placebo-adjusted relative change from baseline was 6.51% reduction. And that was an absolute change of 0.7%. So reasonable relative risk changes that is consistent with what we've seen in other estimations based on other equations, but modest absolute changes, which makes complete sense in that this was not an enriched population. And then shifting gears and looking at the estimated risk of five-year ESKD risk, the placebo-adjusted relative change from baseline at 24 weeks was a 4.43 reduction, but it was a relatively neutral absolute change of 0%. So recognizing that these agents are associated with this dip in GFR, both acutely and sustained as well, and given the fact that eGFR is a continuous variable that is incorporated into these risk engines, we actually recalculated these equations at 4 weeks off treatment. And what we noticed was that at 56 weeks, which is when they're off drug for a period of 4 weeks, the placebo-adjusted relative change from baseline was 12.8% reduction. And now there was an absolute placebo-adjusted risk reduction from baseline of minus 0.1%, which did meet statistical significance. We also performed a few subgroup analyses to look at differences by sex, by diabetes duration, by the presence or absence of chronic kidney disease, and by baseline cardiovascular risk. So we did not really find any differences by sex, by diabetes duration, or cardiovascular risk at baseline, but we did observe some heterogeneity by the presence of CKD at baseline. And once again, this was defined as having a GFR of less than 60 or having at least an ACR greater than 30 milligrams per gram. We were able to see that in participants with chronic kidney disease at baseline, there was a larger placebo-adjusted relative reduction from baseline in the 10-year cardiovascular risk compared to those without. And this was noted with both the Steno risk engine equation as well as the Scottish Diabetes Research Network equations as well for predicted cardiovascular risk. We did not observe a difference in the predicted kidney disease risk based on all of these subgroups, although once again, this was a relatively low risk cohort.
So basically this looks at the risk at baseline and then how that risk changed when you calculate it again at the whatever week time point you're at. And so I guess the question I have is, could you be looking at a very small signal here given that it's a change of a risk?
So you're correct. And that is represented in the fact that the absolute changes are small. They're small, but significant in many cases, but these are small absolute changes in estimated risk. So I want to be very clear again that we are looking at changes in estimated risk. We're not working with hard outcomes. We're working with a low risk cohort. We do not expect this to change practice at this point in time, but I think it gives us increasing confidence that we really need to properly evaluate the effectiveness of these agents in this patient population.
Well, that's right there is what we need to talk about. Is there a future where we see these drugs being tested on a cohort of patients with type 1 diabetes that truly do have a high risk of reaching end-stage kidney disease or dying from cardiovascular disease? Is that anything that could even be possible in the current climate of these drugs?
I think the future is now. So I think we very much are in a very exciting period of time for evaluating these agents in people with type 1 diabetes. There are actually a number of studies that are currently ongoing. This study was actually part of a larger grant to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of SGLT inhibitors in slowing down kidney function decline in people with type 1 diabetes and moderate to severe diabetic kidney disease. And that's actually the sugar and salt trial, which is currently enrolling across US sites as well as Canadian sites. Sugar and salt has two aims, and it very much targets those two sides of the risk-benefit analysis. Aim one is to determine the effectiveness of sotagliflozin, which is SGLT1 and 2 inhibitor, in slowing down eGFR decline in people with type 1 diabetes and moderate to advanced diabetic kidney disease, so a much, much higher risk cohort. And then at the same time, we're instituting and assessing the feasibility of an advanced diabetic ketoacidosis mitigation protocol to demonstrate that not only is it efficacious, but it's also safe. And this will include 150 individuals. These individuals need to be on stably tolerated RAS blockade. They need to have an eGFR of 20 to 60 mils per minute and a urine albumin-to-creatinine ratio of greater than or equal to 200 milligrams per gram. And in this particular case, the primary outcome is changes in eGFR, creatinine, and cystatin, but it will include several secondary outcomes as well, including a kidney composite outcome, changes in albuminuria, eGFR slope, and cardiovascular outcomes as well. There's a large team, but the co-PIs are Dr. David Cherney, my mentor at Toronto, Dr. Michael Maurer, as well as Dr. Alessandra Doria. It's very exciting. I do encourage all our listeners, if you do have patients that you believe meet criteria, please, there is a website. You can also look us up on clinicaltrials.gov. We are currently recruiting for this. So that's one exciting study that will actually lead to data that likely may change practice. Our colleagues at the Steno are also working on a multi-therapy trial, including multiple agents in these agents. Then there's also the Remodel T1D study that is looking at GLP-1 receptor agonists in people with type 1 diabetes. So I think it's a completely different landscape. There are ongoing studies right now that we believe will generate important data to actually use these agents in people with type 1 diabetes and kidney disease.
Well, I think that's great and wonderful work. And I look forward to a future where we can use these medications safely in patients with type 1 diabetes. Any last comments you'd like to make about your paper or the future of this program?
I believe in the importance and value of these studies. And I do thank you for allowing me to use this forum to talk about that. If there are any patients that are listening to this and you feel that you're interested in this study, please reach out and we would be very excited to share information about our study.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We hope to see you here next time.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.